Would you be seated, please? In 39 years of ordained ministry, and I actually checked this, I have never once preached on the passage we just heard from the Revelation to John the Divine. In fact, I have only ever preached any reading from the book of Revelation 6 times. So that amounts to about once every 6.5 years. Now, the Revelation to John the Divine, and please, it is one revelation, not several revelations, as you sometimes hear people refer to it. The Revelation to John the Divine is notoriously difficult. It's cast as a vision, which has been granted to a preacher named John, not the John who was one of the 12, or the John that we associate with the Gospel of John, or the three letters of John. But this John was exiled to the Isle of Patmos. All right, so right away, we can assume an historical background of persecution in the church. A time when the Christian movement had become enough of a threat to, shall we call it, peace, order, and good government, that the Romans moved without compunction to silence orators such as John. I mean, they just voted them off the island, or onto the island, as the case may be. And John tells us that he is describing, and it goes on for the whole book, he's describing his vision. It is as wild as any dream you or I have ever had, and just as difficult to translate into words or images or sequences of time that make sense to anybody else. But this said, and this is for another day, of course, at a 6.5 year interval, I may not even be extant. But the book of Revelation is tightly and precisely organized, usually around groups of seven: 7 churches, 7 angels, 7 seals, 7 trumpets, 7 bowls of plagues, and so on. It is fantastical, but it is by no means chaotic. However, and this is important, it is clearly a kind of literature that cannot be read literally. Dreams may be true, but they're not real. And the book of Revelation is like that. I mean, as with our dreams, we may be able to learn something from it. We can assume, as with dreams, that some of it stems from and in some way addresses historical reality. In John's case, the reality of persecution. In the same way that our own dreams often rehash and serve up a version of something that has actually happened to us in the past day or longer. But it's not just about the past. And this is where we can really get into trouble with Revelation. Because visions and dreams can also intuit a future reality, or the path that is likely to be ahead of us if we continue on as we are, or if we change our course in some way. There was a time in my life, for example, when I had a recurring dream that I was driving downhill ever faster in a car with spongy brakes. I was a driver, not the passenger, in this car. And it was my car. So what do you make of that? Well, clearly, in my life, I was rushing headlong towards destruction if I didn't find some way to slow down in my life. It didn't mean I was going to have a car accident. Do you see what I mean, the difference? It was true, but it wasn't real. It provided true counsel for the future without being a literal prediction. So the revelation to John the Divine can teach us something, but we must beware of anyone who tries to use it as a literal roadmap to the present or the future. Donald Trump is not the beast. Slave Lake is not the Lake of Fire. And the rapture is not occurring in 2020. All right. So enough by way of positioning this revelation to John the Divine in our Christian piety. What actually catches my attention in today's reading is that we have heard the very language which inspired Christopher Wallace's spectacular stained glass window in our upper chapel, named fittingly the Chapel of the New Jerusalem. So listen again to John, and I'm going to dip into one or two verses that are there in the text, but we skipped over for the sake of brevity and every other parish in Canada who doesn't have a window like this. John says, and I invite you to just watch the center window. John says, "Then I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." So do you see it? It's a sort of squarish red part with a corner facing us coming down. Do you see that that's what that is? I'm sorry you're so far away, but I couldn't have crammed you all upstairs. It has a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates are 12 angels. So we can see 6 of the angels. They look like they're the white. White between the two rows of red, there's 6 white, looks like blobs to me without my glasses. Those are angels, I promise you. The city lies 4 square, its length the same as its width. The wall is built of jasper, while the city is pure gold, clear as glass. And I can tell you, when you walk in here at 7:45 in the morning and the sun is shining through that east window, it is stunningly brilliant, all that gold. The foundation of the wall of the city is adorned with every jewel. And you can see the green foundation mostly, and the little jewels all the way around. What I love about this is that we are looking at Wallace's vision of John's vision. It's a layer upon a layer. It's a refraction, one interpretation on top of another. And that is exactly the work of reading the Bible, of when we try to imbibe its stories. That's exactly what it's about. Every interpretation, whether it's mine standing up here telling you what I think I hear, or yours, or Ross's, or some commentator's, every interpretation is refracted through the lens of our own experience and knowledge. And by the time you have filtered it, you have a different interpretation altogether that is all yours. That's what keeps the Bible alive and working for everyone. All right, John goes on. "I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God the Almighty and the Lamb." So at the very top of that center panel, it's a circle, and in it is quite a standard kind of pictorialization of God sitting there holding an orb. And underneath you'll see a lamb, this image of ours, the victorious Lamb of God carrying a victory banner. And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it, he says, for the glory of God is its light, and its lamp is the Lamb. So here is a place, we go back to our dreams and what in our past are they coming from. Here it's helpful to remember the historical context in which John has his vision. So remember, the church is under persecution. It's probably somewhere near the end of the first century, under the Emperor Domitian, who was a brutal man. Many are dying by martyrdom. And some 25 years before, in the year 70, the armies of Rome had marched on Jerusalem, razed it to the ground, and completely destroyed the temple. It decimated the population. There was nothing left for them. They all had to leave. This is where this ongoing desire to return to Jerusalem, to build, to hold Jerusalem, all of our current politics, this is where it comes from, is this dispersion and this desire to return home. Now, no temple. It is difficult for a religion that has a church on every other street corner to understand the magnitude of this loss. We love our buildings, but the truth is, if this cathedral were to burn to the ground tomorrow, we could access all of the means of grace that are available to us here 500 meters up the road at St. John the Divine. We wouldn't have to go far. Whereas in Judaism, there was one temple. Next year in Jerusalem, if you wanted to make sacrifice for your sin, you had to go to the temple in Jerusalem. That was the only place you could do that. There was only one place to pay your vows to the Most High. So that the loss of Jerusalem, the loss of the temple, was an excruciating blow to Jewish identity and their life of worship. The people are scattered. They need to find new ways. And John of Patmos envisages a restoration of Jerusalem. Then I saw the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, like a bride adorned for her husband. Not built with human hands. We didn't have to build it. It just came prefabricated gloriously from God. But you notice that his vision, I mean, it's 25 years later, his vision makes a quantum leap in that there is no temple in the city, not anymore, because he says God and the Lamb are the temple. And then John goes on. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, flowing from the throne of God through the middle of the street of the city. So if you look up here, you see that coming from the throne of God at the very top, running behind the Lamb, is a pale blue. It's about this wide, comes down. And then when you get to the bottom of the foundation, it becomes a wider, broader band of pale blue running vertically. That's the river of life. And he says, on either side of the river is the tree of life. So go back up to the top, and there's two green circles and tree trunks. That's the tree. Those are the trees of life, taking their life, of course, from the fact that they are by the water, important thing in a desert environment. And the leaves of the tree, he says, are for the healing of the nation. There's a reason people don't preach this stuff, because it's so rich and it's really hard to decide which thread to pull and which ones to leave behind. But let's just focus on one thing. Let's focus on the echoes here of the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, there was also a river in the middle of the garden. And there was also a tree. And it was also called a tree of life. But whereas to touch the tree of life in Eden was forbidden and the cause of a curse, here we learn that the tree of life produces all kinds of fruit, one for every single month of the year. In other words, its fruit is available to be eaten in season and out of season. Nobody's going to be hungry ever in this place. And more than this, so far from causing harm to those who eat, the leaves of this tree are for the healing of the nations. And that is why, if you look below, you will see sketched, I think it's impossible to see from here, but in the dark blue at the bottom, sketched kind of in a charcoal gray, is a whole multitude of people moving into the city, heading towards its gates, just the opposite of being exiled from Eden. So do you see that John's vision turns Eden, turns that story on its head? And perhaps nothing signifies this better than the words spoken by Jesus just a few verses later in his vision. And here you just need to look at the top now of the two outside windows, if you can see them. In a circle on the left window, an alpha, like our letter A, and an omega, which is the last letter of the Greek alphabet, comparable to our Z, except, no, that's comparable to our Z, sorry. I'm a dual. But I'm a Democrat. And Jesus says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end, Eden and the New Jerusalem. In other words, John's vision proclaims an immensely hopeful conclusion to the human story. A brand new Jerusalem with new rules of engagement, new possibilities, and no darkness at all. A city that is open to all because the gates are open by day and there is no night. A city that is open to all who long for its goodness and beauty. A place in the heart of God where, to quote Julian of Norwich, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well. Is it real? No. Is it true? Yes. Dream, people. Dream.